Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Today is the full moon day, as everybody is aware. It's this evening, beautiful, bright full moon in the clear sky. And today the weather was very glorious, beautiful spring day. I was noticing how over recent times we've had a lot of grey skies and the weather, damp, rainy, dolorous, hazy grey days. Springtime, but also that's a sort of damp, cool, a mood of unexciting, undemonstrative. Cool English presence. Easily brings a kind of sad or melancholy, depressed feeling, everything soggy, grey, cool. Natural enough to feel that, to have that kind of dullness in the air, a kind of melancholy, somewhat depressing tone, just from the cool, damp sogginess of the weather, the overarching greyness of the skies, wall-to-wall grey of the skies. It's peaceful, but also there's a kind of a dull or sad, depressing quality often to that kind of grey, moist weather. And then today, beautiful bright blue skies, wall-to-wall blue, the forsythia blazing bright yellow in the morning sun, all the grass edged with frost all lighting up in the morning light, and then bright warm day through the day. Can easily bring with it a natural sense of joyfulness and cheer, gladness. Brings a zing, a spring into the step, a zing into the heart. And maybe you don't find those kind of tones arising within you based on what the weather's doing, but certainly I find those influences that is very noticeable to me, that when everything brightens up and the sun comes out, the skies are blue, there's a, ooh, look, happy day. What a beautiful day. Oh, this is natural enough, and this conditioned by the weather, also other events in our life, but particularly just seeing how that works. The weather is one way we feel. Subdued and melancholy. The weather is another way we feel expansive, bright, ebullient. Just by what the weather's doing, just by what's happening in the sky or the moisture in the air. Well, during this retreat time, we've been having a lot of readings, the daily readings from the teachings of Lumpo Cha, Lumpo Someto. And particularly in Lumpo Cha's teachings, one of his ever repeated themes is the importance of not attaching to moods, that our moods, the changes of attitude and mood within us are fickle. They're in a constant state of change, of transmutation. And that our habit as human beings is to try and chase after the good and pleasant moods, the feelings of happiness, the feelings of pleasure. We want to take hold of them, grab them, keep them, cherish them. And the unpleasant mood, the unpleasant feelings, the experiences of unhappiness, feeling sad, depressed, lonely, rejected, incomplete, insecure. We want to get away from even just saying those words, you know, sad, depressed, insecure. Even just saying the words in a Dhamma talk, it feels uncomfortable. A shadow comes over the heart, doesn't it? Just even hearing the words. We don't like that. We want to draw away from that, to not feel that, to not experience that. So when we listen to Lumpo Cha's teachings and follow his advice, you know, we see over and over again that our encouragement is to don't be fooled by the experience of moods. It's just the weather. It's just a happy feeling. It's just an unhappy feeling. It's when you're praised, it's sweet. When things go well, it's sweet. It's pleasant. It's bright. It's like a sunny spring day with all the flowers out and the, all of the heavens singing. It's a pleasant, happy feeling. That's all. When things are grey and soggy and dull, and it brings a sad feeling. When you are criticised, when things that you do don't work, when you're rejected, or something is a pain, brings a pain in your heart, there's a feeling of grief or loss or sadness. It's a bitter feeling, sweet feeling, bitter feeling. And it's completely natural and habitual to pull away from that. But the encouragement of our teachers, over and over again, you know, how many times have we heard Lumpo Someto, you know, Lumpo Cha's teachings saying, this is just a mood, this is just a feeling. Don't be tricked. Don't be drawn in by that. The worldly way is to chase after happiness and to run away from unhappiness, to chase after pleasure and to run away from grief. But if that is all that we ever do with our lives, with our energies, with our capacities as human beings, then our heart will remain forever tied to the wheel of becoming, the wheel of samsara. We just will go around and around and around, chasing after what we like, running away from what we dislike, and never experiencing any kind of freedom, and never experiencing any kind of true happiness. So what is encouraged instead is to examine that process, to explore, to investigate, to apply the capacity that we have to inquire, Dhamma Vichaya, to investigate the nature of reality. Yoniso Manasikara, to look at the root of things, to pay attention to the origins, the root of how things work. What's going on in that pursuit of happiness? Why is it that we pursue happiness and yet we never really seem to be able to get hold of it and keep it? Why is it that we run away from grief and unhappiness, the painful, and how come we can never really escape it? What's going on? How does that work? And it's through this quality of investigation, of exploration, that we we arrive at what really helps us, which is that of understanding. Yeah, understanding happiness, understanding grief. Yeah, seeing how it works. And in that quality of a genuine and direct understanding, which is not just a theory about it, not just having a conceptual explanation, but a real change of heart, a change of attitude, a change in the way that the heart holds those experiences, then we find a genuine freedom. Then we find a truly grounded quality of happiness, a happiness that is unshakable, a freedom that is unshakable. Well, at this time, as everybody is no doubt aware, we have this terrible crisis in Japan. The effects of this huge earthquake and the tsunami, the tidal wave that caused huge destruction on the northeastern shores of Japan, and through the damage to the nuclear reactors, so the radiation leaking and spreading around, the efforts of people to try and control that, they're also just clearing through the wreckage, trying to help people to recover. So many people have lost their homes, their lives, lost family members, thousands and thousands of people still not accounted for, still not quite sure how many people have died, how many people are lost. So terrible trauma, terrible stress and difficulty in Japan right now. As we're sitting here, they are experiencing that tremendous stress and difficulty within their community, within their society. Similarly, in the Middle East, in North Africa, many protests trying to encourage the deposition of tyrannical governments and establishing more fair and democratic forms. So, as has happened in Egypt, also now in Libya and Algeria, Yemen, Bahrain, tremendous conflict and stress and difficulty. People being drawn into deep states of antagonism, conflict, and painful, turbulent situations. You know, these are very difficult, stressful times. Just even talking about those things, you know, you can feel that sense of clamping in the heart. Oh, yes, oh dear, a terrible earthquake and that radiation leaking and spreading across the Pacific and into the water and the food supply in Japan and all the stress and difficulty in the Arab world. And just even hearing the words, even just bringing those themes to mind, we can feel, I'm talking about it, you can feel a cramping of the heart, a sense of sadness, a sense of grief. A sorrowful quality that there is, just to bring the mind to those tragic, painful events in our world happening right now, that many, many people, thousands, millions of people are experiencing the effects of those events right now. So it can be a question for us. It's a key question, a key focus of our practice. You know, how do we handle those experiences? Say, here we are, beautiful, pleasant day, lovely spring day at Amaravati, the sun is shining, the crocuses are croaking, the Forsythia is blasting away with its bright yellow light, and the moon is shining in the heavens. Wonderful, beautiful day, and yet at the same time, other parts of the world, there's a deep distress, deep stress, and conflict, pain, and many tears being shed. Well, in order to develop this quality of investigation and exploring, to look at the feelings that arise from when things are pleasant or delightful, when things are painful or grief-stricken, yeah, the Buddha encouraged us to look and to consider how things work, how life is ordered, how our own life, this individual human life of ours, and the life that we participate in, the society we live in, the world that we're a part of, how that all works. And it's through this quality of contemplation and looking, exploring, reflecting that we can bring that quality of understanding or an appreciation of the workings of things. We can bring that into being. We can cultivate that. During the week, some people came to visit and were talking with me after the meal one day, and this person was saying, you know, she had some friends who were saying that the crisis in Japan, the earthquake and the tidal wave, you know, this was all to do with the bad karma of the Japanese people, and they were just getting the effects, the karmic effects of all of the bad actions they've performed in the past. And so people have been saying that. So what do you think, Ajahn? And there can be this kind of folk belief, or you find that within the Buddhist world sometimes. It can be that sense of everything that we experience is the results of our own personal actions. And it's also, you can have that within the non-Buddhist world, the Christian world. You know, God is punishing people for their evil ways by bringing natural disasters on because of the wrongdoings that have happened. And so that evil needs to be punished in some kind of way. But this is a real misunderstanding of the way things are, I would say, and certainly a misreading of the Buddha's teaching on what causes things to take the shape that they do. When the Buddha spoke about this area, he outlined that there are what are called the niyamas, or five different sets of laws that life functions in accordance with. The niyama just means a law or a pattern of nature. And that the way that we experience things now, the very fabric of this moment, the sound of my voice, the shape of this hall, the feeling of a human body, the fact we have eyes and ears, bones and muscles and blood, we have language, we can think, we have the immaterial world, the rupa khanda of the material world, and the elements that go to make that up. We have the mental world, the nama khandas, the world of mind and how that functions. All these different elements of our experience, what go to form the fabric of this particular moment, these are governed by these five different sets of laws that all exist in relationship to each other. So the most basic of these laws is called Utu Niyama. Utu literally means the weather, but it in this respect it means the laws of physics and chemistry, the way that the material world is built. So that just in this moment we're subject to the laws of physics and chemistry, that and these are not something that are based on personal action, you know, or that you're not personally responsible for the weight of the electron, or that the strength of the bond between hydrogen and oxygen in the water molecule. I claim no responsibility. I was not involved in deciding, exactly how big a proton should be, or a neutron, or the size of a quark. Yeah, these are not the results of personal choices or actions. This is not an individual matter. This is just the way that the physical universe is put together. But we experience the results of that, the way that nitrogen is, or phosphorus, and oxygen, and carbon, and silicon, and hydrogen, what they are, how they're put together. This is what creates the very fabric of these bodies, this hall, stone slabs that we're sitting on, these oak pillars that hold the building up. These are all built up out of these chemicals, and they function according to the laws of physics, of chemistry. That's utu niyama, the laws of the physical structure. Then the second of the niyamas is called bija niyama. Bija means literally a seed. So that's the laws of biology. So here we are. We've got these bodies made of bones and blood and organs, tendons, put together in their very intricate and magical ways. The cells all bonded together to form these different organs and physical structures that live and breathe and that can move around, give rise to various different kinds of activities and experiences. This is bija niyama, the biological world. We're part of the biological complex. And in a similar way, that this is not a matter of personal responsibility, that you didn't create the structure of the cell, you didn't create the shape your thigh bones. You're not responsible for the exact form and shape of a blood cell. This is not something that you've decided upon, or you were part of a meeting to work out what should a white blood cell look like. This is part of bija niyama, the way that the biological world has taken shape, and evolution, and the human species, Homo sapiens sapiens, has taken shape in this way because of these biological influences. So what this means in this respect is that these are laws that govern our lives, that influence the way that we are, the way we experience ourselves as living beings. This is heavily based upon utu niyama, bija niyama, the laws of physics and chemistry, the laws of biology that forms the so much of the structure and fabric of our life, of being a woman, being a man, being a human, having the kind of limitations and capacities that we do as a human being. So then the third of the niyamas is kama niyama. Kama meaning action, or karma in Sanskrit, kama in Pali. So this is the one that gets all the attention, that along with the other influences in our world, there is kama, the choices that we make. So here we are as human beings, and we do make choices. We take action. We do things. We've decided to come to Amravati today, or to live here, to stay here for this time, to visit here at this at this moment, to live here. We've made choices to be Buddhist monks or nuns, to be lay people living in this monastery, visiting here. All the 10,000, 100,000 choices and actions, things that we've done during our lives, the entirety of things that have been decided upon ever since we were small children, any kind of intentional activity. This is all kama niyama, following the law of kama and vipaka, law of cause and effect, karma and its results. This is all part of it. So often in Buddhist folklore and this kind of understanding that gets handed on in a distorted way, They'll say, well, if what you experience, like say being hit by a tidal wave or being caught in a war zone, this is, you know, your karma, your bad karma, or it's the results of your own actions. But in this respect, you can see that it's that our own actions, they're playing a part, you know, the choices that we make, they play a part, but they're by no means the whole story. Just the very fact of having a human body means that we are experiencing gravity, we experience the pressures of earth, water, fire, and wind. We're subject to those forces. That we're going to live somewhere on the planet, that the forces of nature are at work, and it's not all down to just choices that we've made or the karmic results of actions that we've taken, but just the very fact of having a physical body, of living in a particular age, you know, this is all part of the mix, so that it's not just the actions that we've taken that guide the shape of events as we experience them. It's only one piece of it. And the other niyamas, the next one is citta niyama, which means the laws of the citta, the mind, how the mind works, the way that thoughts function, the way that emotions take shape, the way that memory works, the way that the mind recognizes patterns, compares ideas, compares perceptions, the whole structure of how the mind works, the entire psychological realm in some respects, just that has particular laws and patterns that it all follows. That, again, these are not personal choices. We didn't invent the way that memory works, or we didn't invent the way that we recognize patterns and discriminate between sounds or colors or shapes or forms or movement, flavors and smells. That's part of the living system of how that operates. Yeah, but we're part of that. We experience that. Those structures influence what we experience moment to moment, day by day. And then the last of them, and the most refined, is Dhamma Niyama, the basic structure of reality, how the laws of the entire ordering of the universe, mental and physical, the relationship of conditioned and unconditioned. You know, these all, again, similarly function according to laws, to patterns that are a perfectly orderly and organic system, but yet they're not something that we have personally created. They're not something that's down to choices or actions that you or I have made. They're part of a universal system, a universal order that functions according to its own nature. So when we reflect on this, we see that yes, our choices make a difference, and of course that's, you know, the emphasis of the Buddha's teaching is on making wise choices, steering our lives in skillful ways. But to look upon you know, everything that we experience, or the whole shape of the world, or every event that happens in our lives, or the lives of other people, is somehow determined by personal action, is way off the mark, and it's absolutely not what the Buddha taught. Even though there might be folk beliefs on that account, so when we consider in this way, we can see that there's a fundamental lawfulness to the way life works. And when we consider, say, the tragedy of Japan, of that earthquake happening, and then this huge tidal wave washing in and destroying the homes and lives of so many people, it's sad and painful to reflect on that. But also when we consider, you know, where we are, on this planet, you know, this is a ball of mostly molten metal and rock, with a tiny little veneer, a skin around the outside, like the skin on the surface of rice pudding, that's floating around in space. And most of this planet is a molten metal, this molten rock, with this tiny little skin of land and water around the outside, and an even thinner skin of atmosphere. Floating around in an infinity of space, it's no surprise that there's a great element of instability. Ajahn Tiridhammo once told me the story where years ago when he was the abbot at Harnam Monastery back in the early 80s for a couple of years, and he told me how when he was a teenager he had tremendous problems with insecurity. He was very, very anxious, nervous child, and he was always feeling this dreadful sense of uncertainty and insecurity. And so when he was finishing his time at school and was going to go to university, he was trying to think of what subject he would study, and he thought, well, what would be best would be to put my mind on that which is most stable and solid in the world. You know, something that's really firm and dependable. And he thought, rocks. Rocks are the most solid and dependable things. I'll study geology. And so then he went off to the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. He said to his horror, he then discovered that we were floating around on this molten ball of jelly. We were highly mobile and unstable in the midst of a vast space, and that it made him in some respects feel, you know, even more insecure than he ever did before. But the end result of realizing there was no security in the physical world whatsoever, that he ended up leaving the university and going off to ride across India on a bicycle. So I thought, okay, if you're going to meet with insecurity, you might as well meet it head on. But I found that very striking, when you consider, yeah, this is the world is an extremely fragile construct. This body, I've often mentioned how when I went to university, I did a joint degree in psychology and physiology. And at the end of 3 years of studying physiology, I came to the conclusion that this thing cannot work. That this human body is so complicated. There's so many, you know, millions, billions of processes all having to function perfectly, moment by moment, minute by minute, day by day. There's just too many things to go wrong. It's just too intricate. It can't possibly work. Just what it takes to just contract a single muscle, just to bend your finger, is a flat-out miracle. You know, just the workings of a voluntary muscle, just to move a finger, it's absolutely miraculous what has to happen in order to do that. And then you see a film of somebody pole vaulting. You know, it would be like, it can't be done. It's too amazing. It's too impossible. Yet we do it. These bodies work. So when we consider in that way that the life is extraordinarily fragile, delicate, and unpredictable, then when we are meeting with these particular crises or difficulties, or the fact of you know, political upheaval, the pain and stress that occurs in people's lives, then it's still painful. But what we're able to tap into is there's an order that things are following. There's a fundamental orderliness, a stability that is there in the fact that all these changes, all these patterns are occurring in accordance with their own reality. There's a stability to that, to Dhamma, to nature. This is called Dhamma Tittata, the stability, the groundedness of reality, of nature. Dhamma Tittata. And then they function in patterns that are lawful, that are orderly. And this is called Dhamma Niyamata, the orderliness of the Dhamma, the fixity of their functioning. So their substance is in accordance with Dhamma, their functioning is in accordance with Dhamma. And basically the everything that we experience, all the different aspects of our life, operate entirely according to cause and effect. Iddhapachayata, they function according to the root laws of conditionality, the laws of cause and effect. So what this then brings is that even though we experience, you know, pleasant feelings, painful feelings, what this mode of reflection or investigation brings is a sense of equanimity, a sense even though this is painful or difficult, that nothing is out of order here. Nothing has gone wrong. It's something that we would not choose, or we don't like, according to our personal preferences or our own comfort. But nothing is out of order. There's nothing here that should not be. And that, in a way, is what the essence of dukkha is, that feeling in the heart of it shouldn't be this way, or something, the universe is out of order, that things are out of kilter, that this is not how it ought to be. That's the dukkha that arises from craving, from deluded perceptions. When we bring our vision into alignment with Dhamma, when we investigate and align our understanding of things with Dhamma, then we see, even though this is painful or difficult, there's a feeling of grief or sadness, there's no thing that has gone wrong. This is all functioning according to the laws of reality, the laws of nature. So that then there's no grief or no anguish that we create in the heart around that. And this is really the aim of the Buddha's teaching. It's the Buddha pointed out he couldn't take away the pain and loss in people's lives, but he could certainly teach us how to develop the attitude whereby that those painful feelings, that sense of grief or loss, will not cause us anguish, will not cause us the heart to be limited or inhibited or burdened in any way. So the Dhamma teaching in this respect teaches us to let go, teaches us to establish that attitude of equanimity, upekkha, in relationship to the turbulences of life, our inner world, the external world. And the Dhamma is all about letting go, about non-attachment, not getting swept up in those turbulences, swept up in the ups and downs of life, the pleasant and delightful, the sought-after experiences, and the painful, the difficult, the grievous experiences. And this is a major theme of the teaching, as we all know, that the encouragement to let go, to free the heart from grasping. You know, the Buddha said that the cessation of grasping is deathlessness. When the heart is free of grasping, of attachment, then what is experienced is the deathless, that the deathless Dhamma, the Amata Dhamma. The deathless Dhamma is realized when the heart is free of grasping. Also, it said, Nibbana is the cessation of becoming. When that habit of becoming, when the grasping ceases, when the habit of becoming, bhava, is dropped, is let go of, then Nibbana is experienced. The true, genuine, unshakable peace is realized. When we hear these encouragements towards non-grasping or to letting go, towards equanimity, oftentimes, again, this is just as there can be a frequent misunderstanding of the nature of karma and how what we experience is related to the actions we've carried out things that we've said and done. There's also a lot of misunderstanding about letting go, what we mean by non-attachment. Because we can take that idea of letting go, of non-grasping, non-attachment, and we can turn it into a kind of dissociation, take the idea of equanimity, and we can turn it into feeling that we're supposed to be indifferent, that we're supposed to be switching off the heart, shutting down our feelings, that non-grasping is a sort of pushing away and a dissociation, a non-involvement. and a kind of rejection of the world, of the body, the mind, the world as we perceive it. You say, it's not me, it's not mine, it's all sankharas are impermanent, all dhammas are not self, nothing to do with me, all that arises passes away. And even though that might be well-intentioned, this is not what the teaching is pointing towards. It's not what the Buddha intended in that encouragement towards non-grasping. When we talk about Nibbana as the island, you know, I did this this book with Ajahn Pasano on collecting together the Buddha's teachings on Nibbana, and one of the epithets he used for Nibbana is the island, the safe place. And we can sometimes relate to that quality of non-attachment or non-grasping, just trying to get onto our safe little island where nothing painful is going to touch us. Paul Simon and Garfunkel's song, you know, I am a rock, I am an island. Yeah, and a rock feels no pain, and an island never cries, if I remember the words correctly. That we can take hold of that teaching in that way. You know, the island, the image of the island itself is, as the Buddha phrased it, it's the island that you cannot go beyond. That island is this quality of awareness itself. That's the island is not over there, and you know, it's not some other mythological form or some sort of metaphysical place, but the island, the safe place, is this very quality of awareness, this awakened quality of knowing in your heart. And you can't go beyond it because you can't get behind awareness. Awareness is the back wall of experience. That's the island that you can't go beyond. It's this very knowing itself. But we can take the idea of that, and in a way, ironically, we can grasp that idea of non-grasping, that idea of taking refuge in the island. We can take hold of the idea of non-attachment, and distort it so that it becomes an unconscious nihilism, a pushing away, a rejection of reality, of experience. The two extremes of handling the way things are, we can. If the way things are is, say, talking about something that's painful or difficult, something that's sad or brings us grief or a sense of alienation or burden, you know, we can contend against the way things are. We sort of wallow in that. We buy into the way things are, and we wallow in it and contend against it and try to make it, you know, go the way that we would prefer. Or the opposite extreme is to just sort of capitulate and to submit, to become passive in relationship to the way things are. And the way that I like to reflect on this and talk about this is what we are faced with in this is really bhava tanha vibhava tanha, the desire to become, the desire to get rid of, that you are either taking hold of the way things are and trying to shape them according to our desires and aversions and fears, or we're just becoming passive. We sort of switch off and try to not feel the way things are, and that's the way that we habitually relate. We lurch in these two different directions: either the desire to become, to get it to go a preferred way, or the desire to switch off and not feel at all. And one of the ways I like to reflect on this is what Hamlet's famous soliloquy was about in the Shakespeare's play, where Hamlet says, "To be or not to be, that is the question." And I understand many people, English isn't a first language here. So Shakespeare in English is even harder to understand. But in this little speech, which is very famous in Hamlet, he says, "To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles and by opposing end them." And what that means is, bhava or vibhava, that is the question. To be, bhava, and bhava also means to exist. Bhava or not to be, vibhava. Bhava or vibhava, that is the question. He's trying to decide what to do, whether he should, his father has been killed and he thinks his uncle has been the one who done it. But he's trying to decide whether he should take action and bring his uncle down, or whether he should just let it all happen and not make anything of it. To be or not to be, bhava or vibhava, that is the question. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, to just be passive, to just switch off and just let things be, to choose vibhava, to not feel, to annihilate, to try and find happiness through annihilating feeling, to annihilate experience, or to take arms against the sea of troubles, to get up and do something and just change it and make it different, to take up and start a fight, to contend against the way things are. Bhava, should we choose vibhava, to just be passive and submit to the way things are, or bhava, should we act and do something, contend against the way things are? And in a way, he's asking the wrong question. And I think in that one of the chapters in that very book, The Island, previously mentioned earlier in this Dhamma talk, is that to be or not to be is not the question. It's not about being or non-being. It's not about bhava or vibhava. But what the Buddha points to is the middle way. So it's not a contending against the way things are or capitulating to the way things are, but learning how to work with the way things are. And that working with the way things are is the essence of right effort. So it's neither being contentious against how we experience life to be, just being passive. It's not a matter of switching off and not feeling, but learning how to work with the way things are. So when we talk about non-grasping, we talk about non-attachment, we talk about letting go, we talk about taking refuge on the island of Nibbana, this is not about switching off or not feeling or annihilating experience, or because that would all be in the realm of vibhava tanha, the kind of dissociation. And oftentimes this is what we do with the idea of non-attachment. We feel it means I shouldn't be attached, I shouldn't do anything, I shouldn't be attached, I shouldn't say anything. But one of the themes I like to point out is that we are intrinsically involved. Our choice to not do is part of our involvement, if that makes sense. That it's an action that we're taking to choose to not do. And that letting go and non-grasping doesn't mean to be passive or to not speak or not to act. It means to learn how to act in a perfect accordance with Dhamma, to act, to let our actions, our choices, our words be guided by what is in accord with Dhamma in this very moment. That's what it means. So it's acting in accordance with reality, which is the essence of right effort. Yeah, right effort is to do with restraining the unwholesome from arising, or if the unwholesome has arisen, to let it go. To cultivate the wholesome, to bring the wholesome into being, or when the wholesome has arisen, to sustain it, to protect it. Sangvara, pahana, bhavana, anurakana. To restrain the unwholesome, or to let it go if it's arisen. To cultivate the wholesome and to maintain it once it's here. And the more that those efforts are made from the place of the heart being in accordance with Dhamma, then that effort is guided by kindness, by compassion, by wisdom, by mindfulness. These are the guiding forces of right effort, rather than I should do this, I've got to do that, I must get rid of, I have to be more of, I need to be less of, I need to get some of this, I need to get rid of that. There's no I or me or mine involved in right effort. So in terms of how to relate to the sorrows of the world, the tragic circumstances in Japan as being experienced now, the crises, difficulties and turbulences in the Middle East, the European warplanes have just started bombing Libya and attacking Libyan targets this evening. That just began, so another major conflict stirring up there. So how we relate to that with a heart of non-grasping, a heart of non-attachment, is with that quality of openness. We open the heart to the way things are, and then let appropriate action, appropriate response from in our words, in our ways of relating, our choices of what to do and what to say, come from that quality of attunement. And it might be that attunement guides us towards don't do anything, leave it alone. Or it can be, do something, say something, be ready to step in. But that stepping in is part of an attuned response. It's not coming from self-view or reactivity or fear or aversion or desire. And similarly, that leaving alone, that non-action, that choice to be quiet, to be still, to not engage, is also coming from that attunement to what's appropriate, what's helpful, what's beneficial. One of the last aspect of this that is useful to consider is that in terms of skillful response or developing right effort, part of right effort or a way of cultivating right effort is, as we have right in this retreat situation, and we call it, it's a retreat, it's a viveka, it's an aspect of seclusion, and this is an element of practice that was very central. The Buddha encouraged this over and over and over again, that the qualities of viveka help us to develop the most skillful ways of relating, of guiding our energies, guiding our actions and speech in our lives. There are different dimensions to viveka. The first, the most basic kind, is kaya viveka, like physical seclusion. So here we are, 3 months retreat. We're being here at Amaravati, being engaged in a meditation practice, restraining our speech, restraining our movements, following a routine, following the precepts. This is all kaya viveka, the physical seclusion. So that is something that the Buddha praised. There are these roots of trees, there are these empty huts, meditate, do not be heedless, do not be slothful, lest later you regret it. It's said over and over again. There are these roots of trees, there are these empty huts, meditate, lest you be remorseful later. So take advantage, seek seclusion, seek solitude, seek quietude. So physical seclusion is very much part of it, and we have this last 10 days, 12 days of the retreat time. So this is a particular focus on kaya viveka, and this is a very supportive element to how we can develop the skills of right effort, learning how to attend and to explore, to investigate, and to learn how to respond to from that place of attunement. But there are the other two layers of viveka that are more refined and, in a sense, more productive. So the next layer is citta viveka, which is the quality that gave its name to Chithurst Monastery, citta viveka. And this is the inner seclusion, so the inner withdrawal. And this is something that is tremendously helpful, because we can only sustain kaya viveka, physical seclusion, for a certain amount of the time. You know, we have 9 months of the year, not with the retreat time, but with engagement with general activity and the world for the monastic community here. But citta viveka is a tremendously important quality. This is what this is why Lumpur Sumedho chose the word to be the name for Chithurst Monastery, because what it means is that it's a way of withdrawing our attention, withdrawing our habits of engagement and infatuation with sights and sounds and smells, tastes and activities. So it's an inner withdrawal, an inner viveka, the inner seclusion. So even though, and so it's a genuine training of the heart to be in the midst of activity, in the midst of jobs that we have, responsibilities we are looking after, people to engage with, work that we are looking after. There's all the world of sights and sounds and smells and tastes and touch going on in full glory, but there's a quality of non-entanglement. The mind is not going out and getting lost in its moods, getting lost in its perceptions. And this is a great art. This is a tremendous balancing act whereby you're wholeheartedly with the job that you're doing, but you're fully restrained in the midst of it. There's a full engagement and a full restraint happening simultaneously. This is quite a balancing act. But the more, in a way, this retreat time, and particularly this next period we have from tomorrow through till the 31st of March, with a full routine, so morning and evening group meditation through the day. So we'll be in each other's company a lot more. We'll be seeing, having less time alone in our own rooms or our own kutis. But that increased engagement and physical proximity gives a great opportunity to learn how to let there be the full array of people and things around, but sustaining that inner seclusion, that non-entanglement at the same time. So the development of listening to the nada sound is helpful in this. But it's not just listening to the sound, it's more learning to recognize that although the eyes view forms outside, the inside there can be the experience of spaciousness, emptiness. There's no thing inside. The eyes view forms, but inside there's formlessness, there's emptiness, spaciousness. The ears hear sounds, but inside there is silence. There's noise going on, but yet we can also tap into an inner silence simultaneously. We can notice that. With flavors, smells, the whole sensory array, we can develop this skill of, yes, the sense world is there, but yes, there's also this quality of inner composure, inner integration. There's an integrated and composed poise within the heart. The mind is not leaping out to occupy sights and sounds and smells, liking and disliking, judging and choosing, but more learning to cultivate that inner restraint and not getting lost in the qualities of the sense world. And then the last of the vivekas is upadhi viveka. Upadhi meaning the bases of existence, the root defilements of the heart. So upadhi viveka literally means the restraint from the defilements or withdrawal from the defilements. So that even when there is the experiences of like and dislike, fear and desire, aversion and jealousy, those patterns might leap up, but the heart does not get lost in them, does not absorb into them. They're just empty shapes, forms and textures that have no power over the heart. Upadhi viveka. But particularly we like to encourage the bringing attention to jitta viveka, how to withdraw the senses, withdraw the attention from the senses, but yet remain fully engaged. How can we do that? It's a mysterious skill, but we can do it. It's very good opportunity is Sunday morning, when there's a whole crowd of people filling the sala. There's a raucous clamor of voices and activity going on. See if you can hear the sound, just the wall of noise, and see if you can notice that the silence is there simultaneously. It's here, even just in much a simpler situation, just sitting listening to a voice, like right now. To notice, there's the sound of the voice, but there's the silence that it appears in. We can notice both of them. This is the developing the quality of jitta viveka, and this is so helpful because then through the rest of the year, when the kaya viveka is not available, then we can cultivate jitta viveka with all of the activities and engagements that are going on in the perceptual world, in our general rough and tumble of life at Amaravati. That's all going on, but yet there's a spaciousness, there's a silence, there's an inner composure, an inner integration that is undisturbed by all the activities, the comings and goings of the year. And this was Lumpur Sumedho's big insight, that in the early times of being in Hampstead, he was just longing to get back to his hut in the forest in Thailand and resenting having to be in the middle of London. And then after a while it hit him, like, no, this is foolish, Sumedho. That you got stuck on kaya viveka, but if you develop the jitta viveka, this inner seclusion, then you can be quite content, happy here in Britain, and you can be of service to people, and that they don't have to, the people and the activities and the responsibilities don't have to impinge upon your heart. They don't have to be burdensome, and that was such an important insight and so helpful to him, and enabled him to found all these monasteries and be available to help all of us. That was what caused him to choose the name for Chithurst Monastery, Chitta Viveka. So I will finish with that encouragement to us all to look at this and develop this and see how it can be a great resource to us in this immediate future, and also through the course of our lives here at Amaravati throughout the year and all the coming years.
Anyone?
As we've had with the other observance days through the retreat time, we'll have the same pattern today as before, so that we'll formally end the evening gathering now and with the closing chant, and then those who'd like to stay on can do so up to midnight. We'll be tomorrow, with as I said, the full routine begins tomorrow, so there'll be a morning meditation will begin for everybody here in the temple, 5 o'clock. So be there or be square or be snoring. So everyone's cordially invited to join us here at 5 in the morning. But if there are some who'd like to stay up to midnight, then we'll keep the doors open till then and close the temple up at that time.